Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
Now, it should be remarked that this week, an extremely important week, it's Farm Safety Week. And in terms of workplace accidents, farms can be some of the most dangerous working environments in the country because you have live animals, which are obviously unpredictable. You have heavy machinery. You have, in many cases, farmers, elderly farmers working on their own. They may not have the help that they used to have around the farm. And as a result, accidents, unfortunately, are common on farms. So in order to raise some awareness about this, some people who are going to be talking to us today have agreed to share the stories about the difficult circumstances that have faced their family due to accidents on farms. PJ Fitzsimons, good afternoon to you.
How's it going, Ian?
I'm not too bad, PJ. How are you keeping?
I'm not too bad, Brian, thank God.
Still farming?
Still farming away, even though the weather's terrible.
Did you get hit by any of the... There was flash flooding in Enniskillen, not too far from you there. You're up in County Monaghan. How's the weather? Are you indoors or outdoors today?
No, I'm away drawing bales there. I'm away drawing bales of haylage today. That's where I'm at.
Okay.
So it is.
Okay, your line is a bit shaky there, PJ, so we'll fix that up and we will come back to you because we do want to hear. But Philippa Byrne, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you keeping?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Well, thanks very much for talking to us this afternoon. It's Monday of Farm Safety Week and you want to share your family's experience, which is unfortunately tragic. Do you want to tell us about your dad, Martin?
Yeah, absolutely. So 3 years ago this August, the 31st of August, Daddy was killed in an accident, tragically involving a tractor and a disc harrow.
So he went out that morning. He had a large job of work to do. For anyone who doesn't know what a disc harrow is and what he was using it for that day and the job he was facing, maybe build us a picture of the day's work he had ahead of him.
Yes, okay. Well, I mean, I can't claim to know anything about a farm, and I grew up on a farm, but I'm not a farmer. But he was getting a field ready to be reseeded. So he was as such kind of ploughing it up to get ready to be reseeded and turn it back to grass because it was used for Christmas trees for many years.
Right. So not an easy job. Plenty of stumps of trees and everything to be pulled up.
Absolutely.
So he was out with the disc harrow and he noticed a stump, was it?
Yeah, that's it. So it was a brow field, so a hill, you know, he was going down the field in the tractor with the disc harrow on the back. And he came across, as you would, a stump or something, you know, that was kind of stopping him, you know. So he got out and he had a look and just like that, the tractor started to roll. And unfortunately, he went to get back into the tractor and he obviously slipped, misplaced his footing or whatever. And unfortunately, he went under the disc harrow, you know.
And he was killed instantly, was he?
Yeah, more or less, you know. He did live for a few minutes. Unfortunately, you know, I suppose he did know what was happening, which is quite sad to hear, you know, and accept as such. But it was pretty catastrophic, to be honest, you know, even though my neighbours and my uncles and everything were there trying to do CPR and everything on him. But unfortunately, it was kind of minutes as such, you know.
Yeah. And condolences on his death. He was... 61-year-old fighting fit man.
Yeah.
The day he went out to work, good form, heading off out to do the job that morning.
Yeah, which is, you know, totally heartbreaking because I suppose, you know, he was so full of life and, you know, and like delighted to be going and doing this. And, you know, I suppose so sudden, you know, he wasn't done living, I suppose, you know what I mean? But unfortunately, just an accident, you know, something that he would have done many times and before, you know, with all his farming experience over the years. you know, it happened unfortunately, and that was it, you know.
Right. And you were out on a school run yourself, were you? You returned
to... I was bringing the kids to school. It was the first day back at school. So, I was just coming back up the road, and I heard the sirens, and there was a friend of the family that side of the road, and I pulled down the window and I said, "What's wrong?" And he just said, "I'm sorry, Philippa, I'm sorry." And then the guard just sped by me and went up the field, and sure, I knew there was obviously something major after happening. My uncle Tom was with him as well, you know, so I didn't really know who, you know, what had happened or who was it, or, you know, but I suppose when he said to me, "I'm sorry," you know, that I kind of had a good idea
right. That
it was Daddy, you know.
And to leave, for you to leave and go on the school run and drop the kids off, and as you know, as you say, your dad fighting fit to head out to a day's mm-hmm. work, for a family to be robbed so suddenly of the heart of the family in just an instant.
100%. Yeah.
That they are the consequences of farmyard accidents.
This is it. It's so sudden. Everything, you know, is so sudden with an accident on a farm, you know, and you're not expecting it. You're out, you know, making a living, and you know, they work so hard, you know, and as all farmers do, you know, and there's so much risk, you know, I suppose, you know, with everything. And like I said, I suppose no matter how many times you've done it, or you've, you know, brought in the cattle this way, you know, X amount of times, or you've, you know, used the tractor X amount of times, things can always kind of, you know, go wrong, I suppose. And it's heartbreaking, like, to know it's, you know, so sudden. And he was so happy. And, you know, I suppose, you know, was kind of robbed from him, really, you know, his life.
And as we are in Farm Safety Week, and you are talking mm-hmm. to fellow farmers and farm family members around the country, what's the call you'd make, Philippa, today for people when they're heading out to work?
Yeah, I suppose at any job, you know, isn't that it? Like, it's anything with machinery or livestock or anything. Like I said, I'm not a farmer, so I can't claim to give advice on how to do their job, because I don't do it as a living, of course. But, you know, I suppose the thing was, you know, poor old Daddy was trying to save the tractor, you know, because there was a kind of a drop at the bottom of the field, you know. But look, those things can be replaced. Tractors, machinery, livestock, they can all be replaced. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, he gave his life for it, you know, and like by total accident, but he was just trying to save the tractor and, you know, keep the workload nearly to a minimum. He didn't want to have to fix the tractor, and, you know, so.
Yeah, and these things can happen, as you say, very suddenly. We have PJ Fitzsimons back on the other line. PJ, how are you doing?
How are you doing?
Good, Joe. We have you back back on another line. You were listening there to Philippa. Familiar territory for you, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
Can you tell us what happened to your dad? What were you working on?
Yeah, well, I suppose my father, he'd a purebred cemental herd, and I started up my own business making square bales, and he would have sold the herd to help me out. And obviously we needed more sheds to hold hay and straw and stuff like that there. So it kind of led us on to buying a shed. And the father come across a second-hand shed over the road, and he bought it. And we went to take it down that day, a few weeks after. But the first day we landed, we were there a few hours, and he had to go out to get grinding discs or something like that there. And he come back, and we had the ladder up against the roof of the lean of the shed. And the lean had three sheets of perspex on it. And like that, from the ground, standing up, looking up the roof, you could see them. But when you're up on the roof, you couldn't see them. They were completely rotten, dirty, you know.
Right. So they looked from his perspective like any other piece of corrugated iron on the roof.
Yeah, absolutely. He went up the ladder and way across the roof, and I followed him up fairly quick. And I was half as up the ladder, and then I heard the cracking. And I went to the top of the ladder, I looked across the roof, and he's gone. So I went down the lather and ran down to the bottom of the shed, and there he was laying on the ground. He still had the grinder in his hand. So I did. And I had another man there with me. And between the two of us there, I started to do CPR. I got him to hold the cut on his head. And I remember the fall of his two hands could just about cover the cut. He was losing a lot of blood, and his pulse wasn't going. And I started to do CPR, and we rang the ambulance in the meantime. And in fairness, they weren't long about coming. They were there in 20 minutes, I think. And I kept giving CPR or whatever, and they put the machine on him and that. And they walked on him for about 3/4 of an hour. And at that stage, they said, look, we've tried every trick in the book here, and he's not responding to anything. You know, we're going to switch everything off here. And that was kind of the end of it then.
Oh, that's awful for you.
Yeah.
And he was again, in terms of a working man, he was a retirement age, but in good nick and well able to, well fit to be up the roof working.
He was 67, and like that, any job we went to go to do around the farm, he was the first man in, you know what I mean? And he nearly put it to shame how hard he could work at his age. And, you know, there was definitely no sign of giving up. And so that's why he was on the roof that day, you know.
And as you said there at the start, he'd sold a herd of cows to help you start your business. He was a massive support to you as well.
He was. He absolutely was. And he took a big chance on me, I suppose. And he was a fella that kind of come from nothing, really. And, you know, the amount of knowledge he had to pass on to me, and I was only starting out in life. You know, you couldn't really replace that knowledge, like, you know.
And you were only 27 at the time yourself.
I was 27 at the time. Now, look, I would have worked with him a lot over the years and that there from a young age too, but I suppose, especially the way things were starting, only starting off, like, you know, he was a key player in helping me out there, helping me set up. So I lost him at a very early stage of that, but thankfully, I kept going, and I suppose the way I coped was I threw myself back into the work and just kept going, you know, and no matter what anyone said, like, you know, you should hold back here a wee bit, or just, you know, take it a wee bit slower. I just kept going because I found that that's what helped me get through, like. Mm-hmm. So it was.
Well, he must have felt, you know, he had passed on that knowledge. He obviously had extraordinary faith in you, you know, to sell the herd and invest in you. He felt it was job done with the rearing he'd done by the time you were 27. But he wasn't going to waste his money. He wasn't going to throw it away anyway. Definitely. He doesn't sound like that kind of fella.
No, he was a very cute man, very shrewd operator. But he could always see a massive future in things. You know what I mean? He could see stuff that would make money that people wouldn't understand, you know. And that, but Anthony ever turned his hand to, like, he worked out well for him, and he never took shortcuts. He was a very safe man. He would have bred health and safety into me at a young stage. He was a man that wasn't afraid to change the times, and always, no matter what, kept upgrading stuff around the yard and kept trying to make life easier all the time. And he definitely wasn't, for his generation, like, he wasn't afraid to move the times and to constantly try to improve things. You know, especially in terms of safety and stuff.
Right. And you know, when you say, you know, you threw yourself into the work and you went,
yeah,
that was your way of coping. Did you ever have a moment as you were putting in the long, hard days that, you know, did you ever have a kind of a near miss yourself where you thought, okay, maybe I'm overdoing the long hours and the hard work here that you know?
Yeah, well, I know I had to change a lot of things around the place. And changed the way we worked, and I kind of cut back on stock numbers, stuff like that there. But I focused on getting in more help, getting more good help, and through family and friends, stuff like that there, that would help me a big time starting off. No, there was never. I'm not a person for giving up, but I do remember, like, literally the few weeks after he went, like, everything was going wrong around the place. It was mad. Like, there's stuff going wrong, there's tractors breaking down, and machinery was giving up on me and stuff like that there. But I managed to pull through anyway, and I suppose there was a lot of fight in me. And I don't know, I kind of wanted to prove to myself that I could do it, you know what I mean?
Right. It's an extraordinary situation to be in. I mean, any of those situations yeah. where, as you say, things are going wrong in the business and you've got a massive traumatic, shocking grief to be coping with as well. I mean, how much of a part was your father in that?
He was a key player. He was a key player. And, you know, he had nearly all the thinking done for me kind of at that stage, because he would have went through it all, you know, in his younger years and that. And he would have helped me out, give me a lot of advice starting up and stuff like that there.
Right. So, what was his name?
You know, Peter Fitzsimons was his name.
Peter, right.
Yeah.
And Philippa, you're listening to that. Your dad started working hard from his teen years on.
Yeah, well, he did. Yeah, he as he said to me and us, he said he did the intercert, and that was it. Then he called it a day and came home, because his dad unfortunately passed away when he was 10. So he was farming, like I said, you know, nearly 50 years as such, you know. So he did the junior cert and he came home then, and he farmed. And like that, I suppose what PJ was saying, he, you know, always trying to better it, you know, and I think a lot of farmers are like that, you know. He was always like, oh, I want to get up a shed here, or, you know, I want to change the tractor, or, you know, they're always improving and making things easier for the work around the yard, you know. That would have been a big part of daddy as well, you know.
Right. Well, I suppose once you free up a bit of work in one area or find a more efficient way to do it,
yes,
it just frees you up to do more work in a better way, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, more efficiently, I suppose, yeah. You know, isn't that it? And safely, you know, as well, I suppose, is, you know, another thing with him. But yeah, sure, look, he's like them all. He was like them all. They're all, you know, trying to better it and make things that little bit easier, because it is such a hard slog on them, you know.
And you know, you were telling people to mind themselves and take precautions. But PJ, you're here recalling the memory of your father, Peter, as well. What call would you make this week in Farm Safety Week to anybody listening out there who's working on the farm, to maybe just pause 30 seconds on their way out the door? What would be your words?
Absolutely.
To them?
Well, look, same as Philippa's story there. Like my father's, his own father died when he was only 5, and he was pulled out of school shortly after that. Like, I mean, and he was on the farm at that age. Him and the brother trying to support their family. Like, this was second nature to them. And no matter how well you know the thing, you know, you're still going to make mistakes. As she said as well, farmers, like, in fairness to us, like, we're not afraid to move on and change the thing and buy more equipment and try to always make life easier for ourselves. And we are fairly forward-thinking in that. But still, like, I mean, no matter what job you go to do around the place, you know, just take that minute just to stand back and study what you're doing. You know, ask yourself, listen, do I need help here? Am I able to do this on my own? Have I the right equipment? Have I the right machinery? Have I time to do this? You know, simple things like that there. You know, always have your phone in your pocket at all times, especially when you're on your own. You know, and I'm not afraid to say there's a lot of tasks I'd see on the farm there, and I'd say, oh, I'm going to leave that to another day until I've helped. Like, I'm not afraid to say that. I'm maybe admitting defeat, but, you know, at the end of the day, I have a young family coming on there, and, you know, and I don't want to leave them without a daddy, or, you know, maybe, God forbid, end up disabled or something over taking a chance, you know. But I'd also kind of say that the key thing, I think, is educating the young people and educating people from a young age, you know. My wee child has been on the farm since they're 2 or 3 now. Look, you'd pick and choose the days you take them with you and whatever you're at, like, you know, on a Sunday just tipping about, you know. And taking your time with them and putting in the effort, but it will stand to them. And I think it's very important to take them out and about at a young age. Obviously, pick and choose the jobs you're doing that day, but have them there with you. Like, at the end of the day, there's no point in taking a person out onto the farm when they're 18 years of age trying to teach them how to farm safely. Like, that just doesn't work, you know.
All right. Well, look, that's a pretty clear call, and you've made the call for education, PJ. And to you likewise, Philippa, I mean, every conversation that people have where they share an experience, traumatic and difficult as it is for you to share it, is an education in itself to anyone listening. We're going to take a break. We're back in a minute. Thanks to you both.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungain here. Arthur O'Shea, how are you?
Ah.
Go on.
Why am I?
Be honest.
It's absolutely gut-wrenching. Absolutely.
Are you back home in Cork yet?
Back home since last night, yeah. Right.
What time did you land home at?
11:30. Half 11. We did a pit stop for food with the lads on the way home, but it puts into perspective, I suppose. I've just heard here this minute there's been a very bad car crash on the main road outside our house there about 4 hours ago. So look, but it doesn't, it's tough, like tough, on, definitely tough on the players, tough on the management. I feel for them, really. We'd know a good few of those lads we had here from the club on the team, the goalkeepers. So it's...
What part of Cork are you from?
We're Ballinhasic. We're Ballinhasic, which would be sort of about 6 or 7 miles west. We'll say on the road to West Cork, down there. It's a big hurling stronghold here, you know. So it's, you have to hats off to Tipperary. We're a better team on the day. Hats off to them there, you know. That's in the story. I suppose it's a good lesson. I've lads of teenager boys. I suppose it's a good life lesson to people. Don't ever underestimate, you know, in life. Don't take anything for granted. Don't assume. I think there was a sort of a sense out there among a lot of people here in Cork that they really were going to do it this year, you know. So, look, I mean, it's raw at this stage for most, and I feel for the players, I feel for the management.
Who were you at the match with?
I was at the match with my wife, Elle Marie. We're up in the Cusack, and my two boys, Fiona and Owen, were in on the hills. So we've gone to 12 of the 14 matches this year that played. We go every year. I'd have a lot of people who that would be their social life, who go and meet people. We met loads of people up there. It was fantastic, fantastic, I suppose, reflection on Irish society, people mixing and so on. You know, it was a great day out for people. But look, you know, I suppose winners and losers, isn't that life? You're
very kind of well adjusted and balanced about it. You were on the way back down the road, you took a stop in Portlaoise and bumped into into the other side. How did you mingle with the Tip fans?
Look, you know, they're graceful people. Most people are genuinely nice people, good people. You have the usual sort of banter, but when I was passing I saw this man when he was with his child and the two boys were behind me, and I stopped and said, "That's well done to Tip. Well done to Tip." I said, there's no excuses, no answers. It's well done to Tip.
Did you get any funny looks for your sons as you congratulated Tipperary?
Yeah, they'd be wondering what you're on about. But see, that's the way you with people. You got sometimes hold your hands up. If more people in the world did that, hold their hands up, say, sometimes you just don't do enough. You fail. Yeah, we're human, okay. But they're good sporting people who are the same. They had it on. We had the show on the other foot earlier in the year. We beat them well, but there you go. It's the way it should be, and it is hard. And I'm sure we get over it. It's different from last year, I think. You know, different because last year you could have some case for saying, okay, we nearly got to extra time and so on. This seemed to be, look, whatever happened. I'm not one for passing judgment up for someone that's gonna.
Well, that is, I suppose, that's the one that'll separate the good pundits from the bad.
You're the
answering that question, whatever happened. But you know, as you say, you've gone to more than a dozen games during the year. You followed the fans. You're being magnanimous to the opposition fans as well. Would you have liked an opportunity to go out and maybe get closer to the players, at least show your appreciation for the efforts they put in training sessions and everything else? Were you disappointed there wasn't an occasion maybe to go along and see the players?
I think a lot of those events you don't see, you know, I mean, victory parades are for people who win stuff. I think the players and the management, they took a decision. I see a statement out there from the Cork County Board there about 4 hours ago. But I suppose at the request of the players, I think it's too raw for them. I went to the one last year now. It was a bit of a damp squib. Like, I'd say the people, if they want to thank those players, there's going to be a club championship on starting in the weekend after next. Go to those matches and you'll meet those players. They're really, really, every one of them are humble people. Like, most of those sports people are humble people. You meet them, they'll sign your hurleys and we can say thank you that way. I think, you know, I think this time it's probably different for a lot of those people. I feel for the likes of Pat Ryan. Pat Ryan's in his own personal tragedies this year, the coach. So, great, great people. I don't think there's anything you can say except thank you. And okay, we would like to have a homecoming, but I think maybe I can understand why you wouldn't, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and it says in the statement, the Cork Players Management and County Board would like to extend their gratitude to the fans of Cork GAA for their unwavering support throughout the year. 2025 saw two trophies. We will learn and build, because that's who Cork are. The team will return home this evening and spend time with their friends and families, and we'll go again. And that follows an earlier statement where they said, at the request of team and management, there is no event planned for the return to Cork. Cork GAA also pointed out they didn't cancel an event. They never announced an event, and at the request of teams and management. But at the same time, you bumped into those Tipperary fans, you know, down in Port Leash for the stop.
Yeah.
You encouraged your own lads, you know, to be magnanimous in defeat.
In defeat.
Do you think not having an event in Cork might send out the message that there's some aspect of shame in losing?
Do you think
come out in public, maybe, you know, have some kind of an event, win, lose, or draw? Is there?
I could get that people might see it that way. That okay, here we go again. We just stand out from the crowd and we do our own thing. We don't bother with an event. But I suppose if it's at the request of the players and the management, maybe they feel maybe they've put in all the work since last December. They do it year after year. I can understand it, but I'm saying that's just my opinion. You know, if it was me, I would think, you know, you feel you just want it one time with your own. It feels like a sort of a major sort of a blow for you, and you're thinking, you know. But yeah, I mean, I could see both sides. I could definitely see both sides at the event. But if it's requested by the players, if it's requested by the management, then I suppose the other people that really count. I mean, we had the supporters. Like, truth of the matter is, all year we've had great days out with those people. I wouldn't swap it for anything. I mean, we went to many of those occasions. It's a great social occasion. You meet people, it gets people. I'd often encourage people to say, go to those events. There's an entertainment value to it. People, mostly, if you have, of course, people in any walk of life who take exception, who boo and who do all that kind of thing. But I think in general, the message, it's a very holistic, good message that you send to young people, you know. Respect the opposition. Don't take anything for granted. And, you know, I mean, that's the sort of thing. I mean, as well, you know, as someone said to me, the sun rose this morning, didn't it? You know, it's hard, but like it's probably harder on the players and management. So that's why I would say I'd give them a free pass on that.
Saying basically a bit of perspective, and the players and the management in all of this, their wishes are being respected, and you personally don't have a problem with that. John Arnold, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colm, how are you?
Homecoming or no homecoming? What's your view?
Actually, look, because I remember I was at the homecoming in 1972. That was the first All-Ireland. I was only 16, and I remember going up to Cork the following night. And, you know, I don't remember that much about it, but I've been at as many homecomings, I suppose, for teams that last as won in the meantime over the last 50 years. I've been lucky enough to be at, between hurling and football, over 100 All-Irelands, but... Yeah, it would have been nice. I took my granddaughter was there with me yesterday for the first time ever at Indian All-Ireland final. But I suppose the homecomings was a tradition, but look, traditions change. I'm not always for change, but sometimes, and like the last week from Ballinhassig, the point, if the players and management wanted it, I'd say fair enough. But if the players and management, and they're the people who put in behind the scenes, like, okay, we see them when they play in the league and we see them when they play in the championship, and we had some very fine summer days this year. We won the National League and we won the Munster Championship. I suppose it's only the players and management are there in December and January and February, dark nights and dark days when they put in their hard slog, and if it was their wish that they wouldn't, and like, it is tough.
Do you think it might be a mistake, like, though? I mean, people, you know, when they're down in the dumps and everything else, maybe they're not thinking of, you know, the potential benefits of an event where fans would turn out and give them a lift. And when Cork GAA says, you know, the team will return home this evening and spend time with their friends and family, but they also say, we learn and build, that's who Cork is, we'll go again, that maybe, you know, giving fans an opportunity to turn out and give that lift might just maybe give them an earlier morale boost than dwelling on this for longer, you know?
Yeah, but you could make that point, as far as you'd say that if they issued that statement yesterday evening, 2 hours after the match was last. So, I mean, they issued that statement this morning. So I presume this morning after breakfast they had discussions with the players and the management, and that was their wish. And look, they're all amateur players, as Janet Budden said yesterday. They'll all go home tomorrow, a lot of them will be back at work. They don't get a fee for that. They don't get money for it. And I think it's last week from Ben Hessick said it very well. The week after next, a lot of those lads will be back training with their clubs tomorrow night and Wednesday night. They'll be playing championship in a fortnight's time. And everybody will see him. Everybody knows them. Yeah, like, could have been fine. But like, it must be a very, very tough situation to come back. And I've witnessed it myself, like I said, in so many occasions when teams come back after losing. Like, it is very, very tough. And you say, it is a morale boosting. Yeah, it is. But I'd imagine players, sometimes when you lose a match, and I never played at any high level, sometimes you just want to go away into the bosom of your own family and friends and maybe club mates, and once they sink down through the ground. But the last thing you want to be is maybe on a podium waving your hand and smiling, you know, and that's what they used to have to do at those occasions.
Would you have gone if there was one?
I probably would. I wasn't there last, you know, with a family event on, but I remember being there, like, in, we lost two finals in 82 and 83. I remember being in Cork those 2 years, 82 and 83, and they were tough, and we bounced back. We won it in 84, you know. So, like the statement that this Cork, and I would really respect the wishes of the players and management, because they're the people. We just go to the matches, we pay our money, and we get the tickets, and we go, and we enjoy what they produce. And yesterday, look, that Cork team and management with Pat Ryan, and Pat has had a tough year. There's an end of his buried only last Thursday. Like, they've had a tough year. They didn't go up yesterday to end up in losing a match like that. They went up to give of their all, and they gave of their all. On the day, Tipperary were a better team. And as last man said, look, I think she leaving the man with an ibn when Tipperary win. I think the banks of Cork won, and people, we can't explain it. The Cork fellas, public management or analysts can't explain it. Everybody in the paper Saturday, every pundit, and I'm not a pundit, I know nothing about tactics, every pundit said that Cork were going to win this, and I'm not saying it got to their heads. I'm not saying
that's
the
it.
Hype,
they were asked, the analysis team in RT were asking at half time, you know, can you win in All Ireland with a sweeper and that? But I mean, look, as you say, John, traditions changed. You know, the Monday dinner is gone. On as well, it was, you know, so maybe this
the
is just
and the All-Irelands in September are gone. God be with today's one. We'll be talking to you on the first Monday in September. Things change. I'm not in agreement, but this particular thing, I mean, if wouldn't it be a lot worse if someone said, lads, you have to do this, because we always did this in the past, and like, we must do it, we must force fellas to do it. And if the players and management, in their own decision, they're a big group, they're a tight-knit group, they've been together for a couple of years under Pat Ryan and his selection team, and if that was their wish, I would stand by him solely. Of course, the Cork public, especially maybe the public that wouldn't be involved in individual GA clubs, like the last man there, and I'm involved in my own club, and with two lads on the panel as well, there would be a lot of people who would be sporting fans, they mightn't be intrinsic involved with clubs. Yeah, of course they might like to see him, but look, we've had great days with him this year. We've seen him after they win the league final and the epic Munster final that night in Limerick. You know, so like let's not be too hard on him, because like I said, they're all amateurs, and we're all feeling the hurt today. Look, yeah, we're all feeling the hurt today.
So what would you say to them, John? I mean, if you had the opportunity for a handshake at some kind of a public event, you know, pick the player you would have said it to, and what would you have said to them?
I mean, let's say to them, lads, look, we know how you're feeling. You went up yesterday to try and win an All-Ireland for Cork. It didn't happen, but we're still behind you. We're not going to say, the Cork public aren't going to say, is there at the losing two All-Ireland finals? For fuck's sake, we're not going to follow them next year. Of course we'll follow them next year, and that's the great thing about the GAA and about sport. And there are teams, like, I was coming down the road last night, and a girl texted me, and she was saying she was sorry you lost, and then she pointed out that Waterford haven't won an All-Ireland with 61 years. That doesn't mean Waterford supporters won't support them next year. And of course, Cork, and look, there was a special bond between this team. People talk about special bonds, and people did get behind them, and there was a flamboyance in that hurling all the year that didn't just happen yesterday. And like, great credit to Tipperary. People say Cork flopped, but like, I mean, you play, your left play, Tipperary just were absolutely outstanding. Left taker,
there's no taking away from that. Nuala Gorman, sorry John, I just want to go to Nuala Gorman on the other line here, who's listening in. Nuala Gorman, no homecoming public event. The team will return, the county board or the Cork GAA says, will return home this evening to spend time with their friends and family, and you know, they'll build again towards next year. What message do you think it sends out?
I sense that they are very poor. They're coming across, I'm not saying they are, but they're coming across as very poor losers, and they have to realise all the people that follow them and all their fans and everything all the time, and just they would still love to meet them this evening and say, well done, you got this far, and next year, you know, is another year. That's right. My take on it.
So do you think the management should have insisted on their players taking part in the public event?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it would have been good for the people of Cork. It's almost as if they're being rejected, you know, and I don't think that's right.
Right. But I mean, they are amateurs. You know?
I know they're amateurs, but, you know, it's the first time I've ever heard of them not, you know, the losing side, not meeting the people.
Right.
You know, and as I say, it's for their mental health, it could be good for them, but also for the people of Cork.
Okay, well,
and
you're coming, you're ringing from Dublin.
I'm ringing from Dublin, yeah.
Okay, you've seen your share of wins and losses as well. Have you ever gone to any of these events for winners or
not
losers?
At all. No, I don't, Colm. No, I don't really, but, you know, I just feel this, that, you know, because Cork people are such a friendly, lovely people, and I think it's wrong.
Arthur, what do you make of that? Nuala says, you know, Cork are coming across as poor losers, or at least whether or they aren't, that's how it'll be perceived.
I respect everybody's opinion, you know, I do. But I just think, as John there alluded to, I think they're amateur players. They've requested that they want to do it. People that follow them all the time, that have every opportunity to meet those players when the dust settles a bit in a couple of weeks' time. I think it's very, very raw right now. I went to the one last year, and there was a very small crowd there. So I think the idea that people come out in their thousands, it's obvious. Most people, every county in every sport has a bandwagon, don't they? You have a core, and then obviously when people are going well, you have a huge following. Whereas, and I'm sure tonight, if you were coming back with Liam McCarthy tonight, you probably wouldn't be able to queue to get into it. But I went to last year, and I'd say there was probably about a respectable 5,000 or 6,000 there. But I could look at those players up on that stand that night. It was all about public relations, speeches, and the Lord Mayor and Cork County Board. And you could see the look on their faces. All they wanted to be was somewhere else. I don't think it comes across as being unsporting. That's how they feel. They're human, you know. They're amateur. They don't have. They don't get paid to do anything. And I respect what they. But it's just my opinion. I think they're entitled to that. And yeah, we will meet them. I'm sure Pat Collins, the goalie, we'll meet him in a few weeks' time, and we'll be able to tell him, you know, you did well all year. Well done, you know. Next year is another year. Reset. I mean, it's a good life lesson to anyone to say that, you know. You have to take it like him.
Well, what would you say to that, Nuala? Yeah. Cork, you know, they listen to the victors' speeches. You know, they applaud their fans in the stadium. Yeah. Those fans are, you know, gone above and beyond the call of duty to get themselves a ticket. There are probably many of them people who follow them through the less high profile league matches and everything else. And so they've thanked their fans, and they'll, as Arthur says, they'll meet them at a club match sometime soon.
Do they
need to do the set piece event?
Yeah, I think it would have been nice. But then, you know, everybody to themselves. That's just my personal opinion, you know, Colm. So
okay,
leave it at that.
Okay,
okay,
no
you.
Problem. Big law, elegant wear. John Ireland, Arthur O'Shea, Nuala Gorman. Thanks for that. Back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Now, the representatives of road hauliers have come out with a very, very strongly worded statement. Today, they're accusing the RSA of effectively doing economic damage to the country. That's the Road Safety Authority, because who are in charge of road testing. Now, the Road Safety Authority rejects the criticism that's been levelled with them. The Road Haulage Association has said that the Safety Authority has been massaging its figures on driver testing. They say that the reason there's been a 10% drop in waiting times for car tests is because bus and truck testers have been moved over and prioritised that. The Road Safety Authority, for its part, says that it isn't a case that one has been moved to the other, but that certain testers are being used to train up new testers to invest overall in expanded capacity in the truck drivers and car drivers' testing capacity. So, yeah, we're going to hear from a few people on that today. Gordon Sheehy, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
You're aware of this statement and the accusation that's been levelled at the Road Safety Authority. I suppose, give us where you're coming from on this.
Well, I suppose, to be honest about it, this has affected our business hugely. We would have been quite busy. Most of my work would be, Tralee would be my local area. We would have been quite busy in Tralee, and all of a sudden the phone stopped ringing, and I didn't know what was going on. And this is a lot of driving schools I've been talking about. We didn't know, and eventually I rang the RSA. I said, what's going on? What's happening? So basically, we were told that there was no test being done for heavy goods, that the testers, like you said, are being used to train new testers or whatever. But anyway, the heavy goods tests have stopped, and this has decimated our business and a lot of driving schools that specialise in heavy goods especially. Considering the demand for professional drivers in the country is huge. Every company that those trucks and buses are looking for drivers, and all of a sudden it's all been stopped. So that's where we're at. But for our business, we're down at least 80% at the right. moment.
So what's the state of play with your business at the moment? How many drivers do you need? How many are in training?
So at the moment, for example, we have 8 instructors working with us. At the moment, in one area alone, we have 50 people waiting on driving tests. The last time we did a test in Tralee was in May, and we've been told there's going to be no test until close to September. So that's a quarter of the year with no tests in one test centre alone. We also work in Cork and other areas. Waterford, we do a bit in Dublin at times, but this is across the board at the heavy goods. Like they might only be testing 10% of what they would normally test, but most of the testers are doing cars or training new testers or something like that. But
right. Has the demand fallen off then for lessons, for the training you're providing as a result of the difficulty with getting a test? It has it?
Absolutely. And I'm advising people as well, because I get people starting off and I said, don't do any more until you know more. Because when you're talking to someone and they're waiting 20 weeks, you can't say, well, keep doing lessons every week, because that's just not fair on anyone.
Right. How much are lessons?
Approximately 100 an hour, roughly, depending on for heavy goods, would be around that, yes.
Now, the Road Safety Authority says in Kerry overall, it says the Road Safety Authority has delivered 307 truck and bus and CPC tests up to the end of May 2025. They say that's an increase from 261 tests during the same period in 2024. They say they've improved, notwithstanding the fact that you're saying that there's been no tests since the end of May.
Well, that's a fact. But there is more demand. There's more people going for the professional license because they see the opportunities and jobs. And, there's such demand there. And, we get calls all the time looking for people to go driving at our companies. And, it's just not happening. The brakes have been put on the supply of drivers. I mean, and Tralee is another place. I think it's one of the highest pass rates in the country for the heavy goods. So, we take pride in that. The people are passing and going to work, they're going straight into work, and this is. But the effect of it, like I said, there's nothing. It's zero at the moment. There hasn't been no test.
Are you talking to business owners? I mean, you'd probably be in touch with business owners who need to have truck drivers trained, or I don't know whether you train bus drivers as well. But what's the level of demand you do? What's the level of demand that you're hearing from them, and what effect, knock on effect, is the lack of drivers having on businesses in the area, in your estimation?
Well, I'm going to give you an example of an extreme example. I was in the yard a few weeks ago with a company that have trucks, and the guy that owns it said, "Will you buy those trucks off me?" And I was laughing. I said, "I've got enough." I said, "Why?" He says, "I've lots of work, no problem." He was two articulated lorries and good. He said, "I cannot get drivers." He said, "I cannot. I have work. The wages is good." He said, "We're a good company to work for, but I cannot." So I'm actually getting rid of them, he said. And I said, "Wow." So that's the level it's got. I've done this since 2008. And there's always been demand, but especially now, because the average age of the driver is getting older. So newer people need to come into this trade, or we're going to be in trouble. You know what I mean? And that's buses as well as trucks, articulated lorries. Anything that comes to your home came on a truck. So there's constant demand for drivers. It's just, but it is.
Right. So on top of this, you're saying there's a bit of a demographic hump at the moment that there's unfortunately, truck drivers aging out of their career. So you've got the pinch point of, tight training places as well as drivers aging out. Is that it?
Absolutely, we've got both. So there's a big void to be filled, and if we don't get the tests, we won't get the drivers, and that's going to affect things. So I know quite a few different companies, the same as myself, schools, and we're doing well to kind of survive, because 80% of our work is gone and has been for the last number of months. That's a fact, and that's for heavy goods test instructors, buses, trucks, all that. So it's quite serious. But like I said, that's us. But then you've got the companies that are just cannot get drivers recruited. I mean, they ring us a lot looking for drivers. Have you got anyone? And you're trying to see who's around. That's the way it's at.
Okay, Porrick, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
How long are you waiting for a test?
I'm waiting now. It will be 23 weeks on Thursday.
And have you had any word on when you might get a test?
Well, I suppose after initially there, after 15 weeks, I was in contact with the RSA. And what I was told is that I was shoving close to the top of the list and expect a call in a few weeks. But that call didn't come. And again, last Friday. I contacted them again, and they really weren't able to give me, you know, a time frame. Now, what they did tell me was, you know, that the driving instructors had been taken out of places like Tralee, and that they were training up new driving instructors to carry out driving tests. But it seems that this is now having, I suppose, a negative impact on people like me who are waiting to not do the bus and truck test.
Right. And is it feasible for you at all to put yourself down on any kind of an emergency cancellation list and do a test in another part of the country at all?
Well, I don't think so, to be honest about it.
And how much are you paying per lesson? Now, Gordon was saying it's, you know, it averages out at about €100 an hour. But I mean, suppose without getting into the driving school you're in or anything, how much is it costing you, and how many lessons would you need to take? Sure, what's the overall cost?
Well, look, I suppose you're looking at it's €100 an hour, €140 for an hour and a half. So, you know, Like initially when I was starting out, I thought the waiting, but I was being made aware of that the waiting time was 10 to 14 weeks. So, you know, you'd be looking at maybe 6 or 7 lessons. But sure, with the cost of the lessons at €100 or €140 for an hour and a half, it's not possible, you know, to continuously keep taking driving lessons every week or every second week. So I suppose you kind of just, you're kind of just left hanging then, because you're just kind of going to wait off maybe until you actually get called for the test, because it's just not affordable to keep taking them every week.
Right. And look, you're obviously, you're investing in your future earning power, and driving a truck would be a step up. So in the meantime, effectively, you're being delayed from making that other step from your own point of view. Would that be fair to say? Right.
That would, that would be correct. I think there recently, I don't know, was in the paper or was on the television, where I heard that there was a problem with the RSA, where they were given temporary contracts to driving testers, and because of this, they couldn't retain the testers. This was something that was raised at the Transport Committee level, I think, by Paddy Ely, Sinn Féin TD there in Kerry. And I think the response to that was that they were actually going to start taking on full-time instructors, but again, it seems like they're robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Well, that you're using exactly the words the IRHA are using there. They say the Road Safety Authority is robbing Peter to save Paul. They say, you know, that it's a short-term adjustment delivering improvements in overall capacity. And once the new testers are fully deployed, these are the testers they say are being trained by the testers that are being taken off other duties from early September. Waiting times for all licence categories, including commercial, will stabilise and meet service level agreements. And they've also said that they note in recent months the Road Haulage Association has expressed concern over this. But, you know, where does this leave you? You're effectively, you're working in another sector at the moment, awaiting final qualification as a truck driver, basically.
Yeah, well, I suppose, like, at the moment I'm in secure full-time employment, but, you know, I suppose with the level of economic uncertainty that's out there at the moment, you know, I felt like, you know, I should have kind of maybe broadened my horizons a bit, you know, because, you know, have options, you know, if anything was to go wrong.
Right. So not an easy job either, though. Long hours out on the road, obviously, you know, constrained by working time directive and all of that. But not an easy job either to be going into.
No. Well, sure, obviously. But sure, come here. I suppose there's none of us afraid of hard work.
No, fair enough. The Road Safety Authority also said they note in recent months the road hauliers expressed concern about long waiting times for car driving tests, warning of the safety risks that delays were contributing to more unaccompanied drivers sharing the road with professional HGV drivers, and addressing that issue, they say, is a national priority. In other words, they're taking on board that the road hauliers are complaining about unqualified car drivers out on the road. So they're trying to address that situation to make the road safer. And, you know, they say they're trying to address that concern for hauliers, and they'll get around to addressing the other one. What would you say to that?
Yeah, well, you know, again, like, I can see the point in that, and I take their views on board. But I suppose, look, we have haulage companies and we have bus firms, you know, they're crying out for drivers. And these are the drivers we need, I suppose, to bring our tourists around the country, our local towns, our local villages. You know, we need the truck drivers to deliver the goods to keep our economy going. So, you know, I can understand they want to bring down the tests for them, for those waiting for the car, but it's definitely having a very negative impact on those waiting for commercial tests.
Right. Gordon, would you agree with that?
Well, there's something about that that I'm like, there are two separate issues. They're saying they're focusing on getting the unaccompanied drivers off the road because it'd be dangerous to have them on the road. Like, if they're driving unaccompanied on the learner permit, it's illegal. They should not be driving on their own. That's a separate issue to the heavy goods test.
Right, you say that's something that's best left to policing, is it? That the road safety authority should concern itself with training as many drivers across the commercial and private vehicles as they can, rather than concerning themselves with breaches of the rules of the road.
Correct.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, they are the road safety authority at the same time. I mean, their remit covers, you know, making the ads for road safety and all of those other things. So, you know, they have a number of roles they're trying to discharge at the same time.
Fair enough. But, like, if people are driving on their own, it's illegal, and there's insurance implications there, you know, that for learner drivers and cars on their own, that's one different serious separate issue. You know, they should not be on the road when there's professional drivers carrying heavy goods, you know, products, etc.
Right. What do you think they should do, though? I mean, look, you have, how long does it take you to train a driving instructor in your business?
To become an instructor at the moment for heavy goods, it's taken about a year.
To train the trainer?
Because you have to pass three exams, and you have a theory test, and then you have a driving test, and then there are different stages, and the third stage then is the instructor ability test. And again, you know, it takes time. And it's like, so these guys, it's difficult to get people to that standard to do the heavy goods training, you know, but it just takes about a year approximately, like, you know.
So what would you do if you were in the RSA? I mean, should they be recruiting people from the likes of you to be conducting these tests, or do you have any sympathy for them in trying to, you know, train more testers to try and get through this backlog?
Well, I think, like, this issue didn't happen today or yesterday. This has been happening. This has been the trend. And yes, there were testers taken on a year or two ago on temporary, and they were all left go. And then there was the void. So, they have all the figures in front of them. They know what's happening and what the trend has been. So they've got to have a plan that works. But taking heavy goods testers to put them on cars is not the answer. Right. Because you're just, again, it's robbing Peter to pay Paul. There's going to be huge demand for heavy goods tests shortly.
They say they're not taking them. They're not taking the testers on trucks and buses to test the cars. They say those people have been taken out of the system to train more testers. Anyway, we'll await further details on that. Anyone has further clarity on it, they can get in touch with us 087-484-8888 on our WhatsApp. We'll be back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818-715-815.
087-484-8888 for your WhatsApp. Brian Cleary, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colin. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. You were listening to us last week and we were covering the issue of tinnitus. So you're somebody who's affected by this. Give us how it's affected you.
Yeah, my heart went out to the people on the show on Friday because I know what they went through. I woke up with no hearing in my left ear on Stephen's Day 2021. Went to bed with normal hearing, woke up and it was just gone on the left side. And I never got it back, and it was then replaced by pretty severe constant tinnitus. So I had no hearing, and I had about 85 decibels worth of tinnitus in that ear. So it affected every aspect of your life.
And can you give people an idea of what 85 decibels is? You know, how loud a noise is that for people who are kind of trying to put it into perspective with external noises?
It's a coffee grinder, or, you know, it's you know, people living near the airport, if they go out to their back garden when the plane is taken off, if they're, you know, near enough to the airport, they'll be hearing something around 85 decibels. So it's difficult, you know, it was hard to focus. It was hard to hear in a lot of situations. You know, your listeners were describing something similar to what I experienced, where the tinnitus would get louder if you're in a loud environment and there was multiple voices. So it has a sense of, you know, can affect your social life and you can end up isolated with it. So, yeah, it was tough. Yeah, it was a very tough situation. And I totally see how, you know, your callers on Friday, what they went through and how serious it can get.
And what kind of, so in our callers last week, one described it as a kind of a buzzing noise. The other was describing it as a kind of high-pitched whistle or a whine or a tone. What is it in your case, or what was it in your case?
Yeah, for me, I lost all my hearing on that side. So my brain tried to make up sound. You know, it was effectively searching for lost sound. So it was like standing under a waterfall, a really loud waterfall, lots of white noise. But it was also really high pitches. Like if you could imagine a piano or a keyboard and the top keys on it and maybe double the length of it and get really, really high-pitched keys. Those really high-pitched noises on top of a waterfall. So it wasn't pleasant.
And no answer as to how it came about, because, you know, one of the callers last week was a drummer and, you know, he came back from a gig one night and that was it. The temporary tinnitus he'd had before just remained with him and has remained with him. And the other caller, you know, again, it was... not necessary. They thought it might have been connected to a car accident they were in. There's nothing you can nail it down to, is there?
No, the condition is called sudden sensorineural hearing loss. So it affects about 1,000 people in Ireland every year. So I just woke up and my hearing was gone and on that side, on the left side. And, you know, most people aren't as severe as me. Some people will recover, but I didn't, unfortunately. So I suppose it's raising awareness among your listeners, right, that if anyone develops sudden hearing loss, it's a medical emergency. They need to get to a hospital and they need to see an ENT specialist straight away.
What have you been able to do to address it?
So I experienced that severe tinnitus for about a year and I found it, you know, difficult. It was hard to communicate. It was hard to work. I went down to a 4-day week at the time and I effectively started looking at options and one option is a cochlear implant. So if you've lost all your hearing, a cochlear implant will potentially give you access to sound on that side again. And in studies that have been done the last 10, 15 years in a few European centres, they found that giving people cochlear implants when they've got single-sided deafness also improved the tinnitus. So I was lucky I was approved through the HSC Treatment Abroad Scheme to get one. I got it in Charité in Berlin at the end of 2023 and I was activated at the start of 2024. And, you know, I heard the doctor saying, can you hear me through the cochlear implant? Went outside, I could hear my kids in stereo and all the traffic and went back to the hotel. And that was the first time I heard silence in a year when I got back to the hotel. So right. It was amazing. I was very lucky. Not everyone gets that outcome. I was delighted to be able to access that through the Treatment Abroad Scheme.
And as you say, look, some people, the bad news they get, including one of our callers, was told, you know, that people would just have to manage with tinnitus as a lifelong condition. For you, the cochlear implant that dealt with the single-sided deafness also addressed the tinnitus. So,
yeah, I'm in the minority. Yeah, I'm in the minority where I found an effective, you know, treatment for my tinnitus. But like when you don't have hearing, you know, when you lose your hearing and you're getting advice from people to, oh, mask it, you know, background noise. And I had no hearing to mask the tinnitus with, you know, so some of the advice can be kind of difficult to hear, you know, ignore it and it'll go away. You know, if it's literally roaring on one side of your head, it's difficult to ignore it, you know.
Right. And you're trying to raise awareness and be of a bit of a help. And there's a strange connection here. For anybody who's into vampires, what's the Bram Stoker connection to the work you're doing?
Yeah, so while I was learning to use the cochlear implant, I was off work for a little bit and I did some archival work in the National Library of Ireland in their reading room there and I found a lost short story by Bram Stoker called Gibbet Hill. So I ended up publishing that with the Rotunda Foundation, who kindly supported it being published in a book last year. So I worked with Paul McKinley, who's an artist, and Paul Murray, who's a Stoker biographer. Okay. And Roddy Doyle very kindly gave us a foreword as well. So that was published for the Charlotte Stoker Foundation. So that was Bram Stoker's mother, and she was an advocate for education of deaf children back in the 1860s. So okay. There's a nice circularity to the whole story.
Indeed. That, well, look, fair play to you, and thanks for calling in on that, because your experience is obviously, as you say, a minority, but good to get that perspective on tinnitus and indeed sudden deafness and the work you're doing as well. Thanks a million for that, Brian Cleary.